You said about having read Barry's, a few, maybe a couple nights after Alex Preti's execution. And you said you wish you hadn't read this story that night. You want to talk about that?
Yes. This is The Lonely Voice with Peter Orner from Texas Public Radio. I'm Yvette Benavides. On this episode, Peter Orner is in the TPR studios in San Antonio. Before he arrived, he and I had been texting about the stories of the Russian writer Varlam Shalimov. Shalimov was a journalist and a writer. In 1936, he was arrested for counter-revolutionary activities and sent to the Soviet Gulag. After surviving 15 years in prison camps, he was released and would go on to write short fictional stories that reflect the years he spent in the Gulag. The first volume, Kolyma Stories, was published by NYRB Classics in 2018. The translation is by Donald Rayfield. This volume, along with a second one titled Sketches of the Criminal World, with the translation by Alyssa Valles, make up the first complete English translation of Shalimov's stories, the only one based on the authorized Russian text. As remarkable to us as this access to these stories 90 years after Shalimov was first arrested is how they can still matter so much. In 1951, when he started writing, Shalimov was focused on a particular place and time, not as a journalist, but as a story writer. He brings such humanity to the telling, a poetry to the descriptions of the place, the hunger of the people, the uncertainty and the fragility of life that ruled the day. For us, in 2026, there are still challenging themes to understand about persecution and inhumanity in these stories. But there is far more than that, and we find that we are moved by glimmers of resonance and of hope and light in the most abject and distant of places. Here now, Peter Orner and I discuss Barry's by Varlam Shalimov. We also talk about the story At Night and RUR. All of the stories can be found in the collection, The Kolyma Stories. So I think I was supposed to be reading some other stories that we were going to cover, and I started to read Barry's just coincidentally, and was watching the news and was seeing all about what happened to Alex Preti, and I thought, I wish I hadn't read the story. It just, I think it was a much more somehow visceral experience, maybe. I don't know. I don't know. I'll never know, because, I'm reading the story for the first time at the same time as that thing happened. So, a book like this, the Kolyma Stories collection by Shalimov, it does kind of put you in the mind of that, like, bitter cold and the exposure to the elements and, the sheer sort of unchecked violence that can happen in certain circumstances, and certainly in 2026 in the United States of America, in Minneapolis, Minnesota. You don't think that it's kind of an unchecked thing that's going to happen, but it kind of is. The stories in this book, because it's been kind of cold and it's been kind of terrible and deadly just to exercise your rights and your freedoms, the stories hit kind of different.
Yeah, I mean, I think, Shalimov might not be a familiar name to a lot of people. He was a Soviet writer who born in 1907, lived to 1982, and he, according to the introduction, which I have no reason not to believe, he was one of the rare survivors of Stalin's Gulag. And not only did he survive, but he survived to write six volumes of stories about those times. And they were recently, or a few years ago now, what was the date on this book? 2018, the NYRB started to bring out the first edition of, I think, a three-volume set of these stories of from the six that he published. So this first volume, Cuomo Stories, is the first three books, and then there's going to be another three, and then another three again. The second volume's out already. They are absolutely extraordinary, and we say that for everyone we talk about, but maybe that's because we only do the very best people, you know, and only the very best stories that we know of. So of course we're going to say that, but in this case, I think you had mentioned him a week ago or something. It feels like a year ago, but it hasn't been more than 10 days since you said, hey, but why not Shalimov? And it made sense then. It makes even more sense now, because Shalimov is somebody who, you know, firsthand knows where totalitarianism can take us. But I think that is sometimes the end of the story with him. And I want to emphasize some criticisms of the translator, especially in the introduction, that have been out there on some coverage of this book over the years. And that is that while this is a fantastic, his name is Donald Rayfield, and he deserves a great deal of credit for being a very, 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 very good translator, he says some stuff in the introduction that kind of leans towards, you know, this is autobiography, these were his experiences, and it gives the sense, and I don't think he quite meant this, but gives the sense that what did Shalimov do to create these stories? He wrote them down because he remembered them. That, we know, is way, way, way not understanding the way these stories were created and the art that is behind them, the timing, the brutal timing is, you know, it isn't just that Shalimov survived this and witnessed it. It's that, you know, we're dealing with somebody who was, you know, in my view, one of the very, very great story writers. Let's get into the story, because that's where we're sweet spot is. We don't have to experts on Shalimov.
Okay, but something I do want to say about what you were saying is that, yes, this guy went through... Okay, I'm going to read it off the back of the book.
Yeah.
15 years that he spent in the Soviet Gulag, right?
Right.
6 years as a slave in the gold mines of Kolyma, before finding a less intolerable life as a paramedic in the prison camps. And he began writing his account of life after Stalin's death in 1953. And then his stories are at once the biography of a rare survivor, a historical record of the Gulag, and a literary work of unparalleled creative power, insight, and conviction. I want to point to that because you were talking about how we can diminish what he was, what his stories are all about, if we simply say, hey, this happened to him and he wrote it down. As a story writer, and I'll go one further, as a master of the story form, and we know that he is considered that, and we consider him that too, there is a tremendous amount of creativity in being able to tell a story about the most abject, miserable, terrible things that can happen to somebody. And we're interested in reading about it. Does that make sense?
100%. And the other thing I'd just add is that, you know, people might be like, well, I don't want to, you know, I get enough horrific stuff in the news. I don't want to read about more bad stuff. If you're at all interested in unparalleledly good short stories of the 20th century, then you're missing out. And so, yes, the stuff is hard. And as you said, when you read Barry's in the context of the killings in Minneapolis, it was hard. But Barry's is a truly extraordinary, compressed piece of work that, yeah, is about an execution, because a guy went a little bit too far past the marker that said you couldn't go past that point, and he picked some berries, and they shot him for it. that's how life worked in the prison camps in the Gulag. That said, and maybe it's weird for us to focus on the artistry of the truth, because this is certainly the truth. So I don't know. I'm kind of, you kind of go back and forth between that, but you know, and I'm sitting there, wow, this is such a damnly great put together short story, but it is.
And why do you say that? That it's a great short story. Like, okay, given everything that we've just said about how it documents true facts and true things, true terrible things, in sort of like, we can think about the way that people think about a space like this as, well, there's nothing to it. It's cold, there's snow everywhere, it's horrible and uncomfortable, and people are just criminally violent to each other, the end, you know, right. But it's not. But what else is there, like, for you as a great short story?
Everything. Let me just give you one example. The snow had been driven away by the wind. The dead, frost-covered grass was slippery to the touch and changed color on contact with a human hand. Low mountain briars froze on the hills. Their frozen, dark, violet berries had an extraordinary smell. The bilberries, a bluish-gray, touched by the frost and overripe, were even better to eat than the briar hips. Blueberries hung from short, straight twigs. They were bright blue, wrinkled like empty leather purses, but they contained a dark, bluish-black juice of an indescribable taste. At this time of year, the frosted berries were quite unlike ripe berries when they are full of juice. They had a much more subtle taste. My comrade, Rabayakov, collected berries in a jar whenever we broke off for a cigarette, and whenever Seroshkapa wasn't looking in our direction. If Rabayakov collected a whole jarful, then the guard's cook would give him bread in exchange. Rabayakov's enterprise immediately became crucial to him. I mean, I just feel like reading on, because it's so, I mean, the language is never bloated in any way. It's incredibly direct. It puts us there completely. So the fact that, yeah, he was a slave laborer for 15 years, and then 6 years before that, before he spent some time in Moscow, and then he got rearrested. Yeah, I mean, as a document of Kolyma, this is essential. But if I'm documenting prison conditions and horrors, then maybe I'm not focused on the berries. Shalamov is focused on the berries. In other words, in the most abject conditions, he is at the same time, because of pure survival, but also because he's a human being still alive, barely. So one of the most amazing aspects of this book is the human relations between the prisoners and how completely diminished they are, and yet, they are still, you think about Primo Levi writing in Auschwitz, they are still, the human connections are still somehow human. And I don't know if that diminishes it to say it, but for some reason, the fact that these prisoners are able somehow, even though they are only focused on their own survival, to exist with each other as human beings, it makes these stories a kind of honoring of that.
Yeah, I was thinking about how that section that you just read, the focus, I'm just going to use the word that you don't like, but the defamiliarization of the berry.
I like it.
I mean, it's not totally defamiliar. I don't know if it is or if it isn't. But just
is like, what does that mean?
It's just like this. You take something that's very commonplace and you make it strange by over-describing it, by like really describing it, like really, you know, do you really need to describe the berry? People know what a berry is like. But when you defamiliarize it, you know, you basically are making it strange. You're making it new, and we pay attention to it. And part of that for me is like the sensory imagery of that is coming from the point of view of an extremely hungry person.
Yeah.
A person who is extremely deprived.
Starving.
Yeah. Yeah. And to me, it doesn't say we were starving, but we read that and we realize a lot about what's going on in this space. And it's also, besides that, it's also very gorgeous.
You know, I think Shalomo wasn't going out of his way to do any of this. No. I think he was just trying, you know, in hindsight, and there's a later story called RUR, which I love, which he refers to this. He says, prisoners couldn't possibly be thinking about, for example, some kind of metaphor about our experience while we were in it. But 20, 30 years later, we can. And I think it's important to think about the fact that these stories weren't written in real time. They're not, with all respect, journalism. They are memories turned into art, you know, and they're hard to read. But again, the brilliance of them is so transcendent that it makes it, you know, even if it's hard going, I'm still loving them. And you said they're really beautiful. You're talking about hunger and how to write about hunger. This is the first paragraph of a story called At Night. We're doing two today. Supper was over, and we'll bounce back and forth. Supper was over. Glebov took his time licking his bowl clean, then carefully raked the bread crumbs off the table into his left hand, which he lifted to his mouth so as to lick every crumb off his palm. Without swallowing them, he could feel the saliva in his mouth greedily covering the tiny lump of bread in a thick layer. Glebov could not have said whether it tasted good. Taste was something indifferent, too weak compared with the passionate, oblivious feeling that food gave him. Glebov took his time before swallowing. The bread melted in his mouth, and it melted quickly. And this is the other guy, Bagaristov, could not take his sunken, shining eyes off Glebov's mouth. Nobody had the strength of will to avert their eyes from food disappearing into somebody else's mouth. So, you know, and again, people might be hearing this like, oh, it's too hard. But there's certainly comedy in these stories, and there's certainly a lot of life, and there's some of the best writing that I can possibly imagine.
When you go back to the Barry's story, do we want to go to that section that follows about, I never thought of helping Rebikov to pick berries, and he would have refused any help, for he would then have to share the bread, right? Because he trades the berries. His jar was filling up too slowly. It was getting harder and harder to find a berry. And without having noticed, we were getting close, to the limits of our zone. The markers were hanging over our heads. Watch out, I told Rybakov. Let's go back. So he warns him and everything. I mean, he's conscious of where they are, and he has a lot of situational awareness that the other guy seems to be lacking. And things get very bad.
Yeah, and in the next paragraph, ahead of us were tussocks covered with briar hips, blueberries, and lingonberries. We spotted these tussocks before. It would have been all right if the tree from which a marker bundle was hanging had been 2 meters far off. But, I mean, imagine you're just, you know, the lingonberries are just within reach. And when you're that desperate, you may well take that chance. And that's what happens. And this is one of, I don't know how many stories are in this first volume, what, 60, 70, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And they're all different, but they're all capturing aspects of this experience. Again, in this completely compressed and often, and I don't want to use the word transcendental in a stupid way, but they feel like, I guess they feel like they do such honor to these people because they bring them to life, back to life, because most of the people he is describing did not make it out of this. And oftentimes, apparently, Chamalov uses real names because these are all people who he has known. Again, through the lens of creating fiction around them, but these people did walk the earth, and this is probably in most cases these stories are the only record. So whoever Rybakov was, whether he was Rybakov or whether he was based on someone else, you know, he's I don't think this would help. It doesn't help him at all, but he is, he's here. He's in these three pages. And, he sacrifices his life for these berries. And, it ends on a comic note, you know.
Well.
Dark humor.
So it says that he pointed to his jar, which was still not full, and to the sun, which was now setting. Yeah. So he's saying, he points to the jar, he points to the sun as if to say, the sun is going down, I need to work fast, let me take advantage of the daylight, and began slowly to approach the enchanted berries.
Yeah.
There was the dry crack of a rifle shot, and Rybakov fell face down between the tussocks. Sereshapka waved his rifle about, shouting, "Leave him where he is. Don't come near." I mean, doesn't that,
right? just because you experience doesn't mean you can get it down like this. But then the next thing also echoes so strongly, which is the lying that comes with this. Even in this, you know, you think in Stalin's gulag, they wouldn't need to lie like this. But everyone's got like some kind of, even the worst of the worst has some kind of code. And because Shalamov and other people in the gulag weren't killed, there was some reason they were kept alive, arguably, because they were so expendable, right? But then you violate one stricture and you're dead, is what happened to Rybakov. But then, with a click of his bolt, Seraskpa reloaded and fired another shot. Forgive my pronunciation of these Russian names. But with a click of his bolt, Seraskpa reloaded and fired another shot. We knew what the second shot meant. So did Seraskpa. They were supposed to be two shots. First, a warning shot, right? So they're covering their tracks. Because there is some possibility, perhaps, that somebody higher up would ask, well, wait a second, why was there only one shot? You know? Mm-hmm. I mean, we don't need to take the parallels so far, but the sense of moral depravity, even in the context of remembering to fire that second shot so it looks like, you know, there was a warning shot and that the victim himself was the reason why he was shot.
But then... I mean, as we go on, there's more. There's actually, and it's something so heavy about.
It sounds so heavy, doesn't it?
Oh, it's very heavy. It's very heavy.
But I feel like maybe that's some of the art of it. If they don't feel heavy reading them, there is a kind of, I don't know, buoyancy to them. Like some, you know, like I don't know. I don't feel weighted down by these stories in a way that I might feel if they were in lesser hands. Like that's why I go back to this honoring idea. Like he's honoring these people, and I think we need to honor them by experiencing these stories. And he is not hitting us over the head with how bad this is. He's just being seemingly straight in an artful way. But anyway, I interrupted.
No, I was just going to say, because of what happens next. Well, not quite next. It says Rybakov lay between the tussocks. He looked surprisingly small.
Yeah.
The sky, what I like here is the narrator's perspective about a detail that you might not even ever think about. The sky, mountains, and river were enormous. God knows how many people you could have laid down on the footpaths between the tussocks in these mountains. Hmm. Why think about that? That's just a very interesting thought that came to him. Rybakov's jar rolled some distance away, but I managed to pick it up and put it in my pocket. Perhaps I might get some bread for the berries. I knew whom Rybakov was picking them for. Now you have to take a step back and try to think about this move that he makes. It's like, are we going to judge him for doing that? some perfectly good berries, some perfectly good bread to be had, you know. But in a situation like this, I don't know, all bets are off. Sarah Shupka calmly assembled our small squad, counted us, gave the order, and took us home. He touched my shoulder with the tip of his rifle. I turned around. "I meant to get you," said Sarah Shupka. "But you wouldn't stick your head out, you bastard." What does that last bit say to you about the situation? And even how we think about 2026, frankly.
I can't help but just think about how he ends this story. You know, with, there's so much more to say, possibly.
There is.
You know, probably the prisoners bury the body. Probably this isn't the end of this story in some ways. So to me, it's this idea of just, you cut a story off at the knees. But I also think that the shooter is also gets a moment of honesty here. "I meant to get you, but you wouldn't stick your head out, you bastard." Bam, done, we're over. We're going to the next one, which is going to be just as hard. But I feel like as a story, it completely just knocks you over.
I mean, how interchangeable these people were to him, to the shooter. It's just like,
absolutely.
Why did he shoot him? He went too far. Was it because he went too far off beyond the perimeter that they were supposed to stay within, or what was going on? It really is about just the fragility of life there, the uncertainty. They just didn't know what was going to happen. I mean, that he had established this trading thing of the berries for the bread. It's actually kind of excellent. I mean, it's just such an excellent entrepreneurial thing that was happening. And but he went too far, apparently. And yeah, the trees were sagging with fruit, you know.
You mentioned interchangeability, and I think that if there's anything we can see how things play out when you believe that people are interchangeable, you know. And we don't need Shalom to tell us this, right? Mm-hmm. But this is a supreme example of this kind of mindset. And not only do the jailers have it, but the prisoners themselves. And in the other story, mm-hmm. in the night, mm-hmm. these are two guys, another set of guys, another two prisoners, who have been imprisoned for quite a while together. And yet over the years, they've been so busy surviving that they have not had a chance to have a proper talk. They haven't sat down and said, "Well, you know, what did you do before you got nabbed and sent out here?" There has been no time for that. But in this tiny glimpse, it's another glimpse, you know. And I think of these stories as glimpses or visions, or, you know, yes, they're nightmares, but they are. I keep going back to the fact that if you think like, "Oh, I don't want to read about that," then you're denying yourself getting to know these people. And I think that's what Shalamov gives us, is he gives us these people in their most extreme moments in their lives. And they don't always, you know, I think that moment you pointed out with Rybakov, you know, lifting the jar to the sun, is that's the last thing he did on Earth, whether it's a piece of fiction or whether it's a fragment of a memory that Shalamov had, he turned it into like this visionary moment.
Well, I'm sorry, I can't help it.
Yeah.
But the pointing to the jar.
Yeah.
Pointing to the sun as if to say, "I need to work fast, I'm almost done."
So you're getting the practical. Like, I didn't even see that.
But it's a little bit like, "I'm not mad at you, man." And a little bit like, you know, holding your hand up and saying, "I'm going to go help this woman you just shoved into the snow." You know, it's like, it is a kind of a communication from the person that we learn is about to get shot. I don't know. This is why the text of I picked the wrong time to read the story, or maybe it was the right time to read the story.
Maybe it was the right time, because I don't know, in the moment when we're all so rageful, rightfully so, I think what these stories show us is what we might think about 30 years from now. These stories were not written in the moment. These stories are written decades after, and most people aren't going to be thinking about it. But I love what you say about that moment, because just as a very basic, like, you know, what to do, how to write a great story.
But that, you know,
it feels ridiculous to say. I feel stupid saying it.
But that Shalamov doesn't explain it to us. He simply describes what the person did. Point to the jar, point to the sun. No words have to be expressed. He doesn't have to say, I'm almost done, give me a second.
Right.
And it's almost more powerful that it was a wordless sort of communication, but one that was loud and clear and understandable and still, you know, and still his fate was sealed.
A lot of times, I think, writers take their eye off exactly the moment when they shouldn't. And Shalamov shows us here, no, you know, and you said it, like he raises it up. Like it's a physical, you know, and it's the right before the shot is fired.
Mm-hmm.
So you can imagine, like, the shooter. Did the shooter notice what you noticed? Notice that he was going past the border. That's all that mattered.
That's all that mattered, yeah. Not that he was basically saying, hey, just give me a second. I got to do this.
Right.
Let me finish this up.
Right.
Let me get out of here. Let me make a U-E and just get out of here.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think that says it, everything. I really do. I really do. I the only thing I'd mention is about at night is that there's this moment of the situation in At Night is two men have gone out at dusk. The moon has just come up. And they have come out at dusk to take the clothes off a recently murdered man who's been put in a shallow, really shallow grave a bit off from the camp. And so they hike out there, the two of them, to get the clothes. But in the course of that, they're exhausted because they're so weakened. The reason he's in such the man who was shot is in such a shallow grave is because they don't have the strength to dig very deep. So these guys are trying to get the rocks off the dead guy. And one of them, Barastov, cuts himself. And he wraps his some dirty cotton wool from his shirt from his jacket lining. To stop the bleeding, but the finger's still bleeding, and Glebov is the man he's out there with says, "Bad clotting," just like reflexively. And Bagristov says to him, "Are you a doctor then?" Glebov doesn't answer. It seemed a very long time ago that he had been a doctor, and had he ever been one? Far too often, the world beyond these mountains and seas seemed to him like a dream or a fiction. What was real was the minute, the hour, the day from reveille to the order to stop work. He never let his mind wander any further, and he could not have found the strength to do so, like everyone else. So he has this past as a physician, but it's he doesn't even remember it. So why would he tell other people he'd run around saying he's a doctor? It's just not, it isn't, they have been stripped completely. And that's why when you said interchangeable, they're interchangeable to themselves. And yet they have these glimpses, these moments, these tiny things that they have in a day. Unlike the guards, there is some humanity in the prisoners. Still, you know?
Yeah. They had a story and a past and a life and... Yeah.
But it doesn't, there's no time to go. He says, "Are you a doctor?" Then he doesn't answer.
Yeah.
So it isn't, they don't have a conversation about it. It's, there's no energy or time for that.
Because he says he couldn't find the will to reply and he wasn't trying. Whatever mind he still had left, and it might well no longer be a human mind, had too few facets. At the moment, it was forced on one thing only, to move the stones as fast as possible. Like, that's the only objective here. It doesn't matter what he was in the past or who he was before. As you say, they're stripped down to all being sort of the same, interchangeable. And I'm sorry, I cannot help but think about, I mean, many examples in history, as you know, but also the current situation with detention. And, you know, the idea of not wanting to give these, not wanting to give people their stories and their humanity and their experiences and the lives that they've lived, and really just stripping them down to one thing and one thing only. So for somebody who was a doctor, you know, it's like that just dissolves away. It doesn't even matter. The only thing that matters is, are they going to be able to move these stones as quickly as they possibly can? Because they are on a little bit of a mission here to be able to get, to extract something very particular from this person in the shallow grave.
I can see the impulse to mention, you know, detention, just because we're sitting here in San Antonio. And as of yesterday, that little 5-year-old who's been in the news is still, what, 40 minutes from here?
Mm-hmm.
And you know, people were tear gassed in front of the detention center 2 days ago. What's going on inside there we know is horrific. And so, you know, I had this fantasy just now when you were saying, you know, and it's so stupid, I can't even say it. You want to hear my fantasy? Like Stephen Miller reading a story like this. Or you know, I mean, and I'll just say it. As a Jewish human being, I don't know if he's a human being, and I certainly don't know if he's Jewish, but allegedly he's a Jewish human being. Allegedly. You know, has Stephen Miller read Primo Levi? Right? We know that literature from what? From, was it Auden who said, it doesn't change anything. These people don't read it. You know, you think about Stalin reading Isaac Babel or reading Shalamov. You know, Shalamov could not write until Stalin was dead. But there are, you know, throughout literature, there's all kinds of fantastical ideas that what if they did, you know, what if they did? These situations always happen because there is no way in hell that the Stephen Millers of the world would read these 3 pages. And God knows he does not listen to TPR or this podcast, but that would be my challenge to human beings, alleged human beings like that. What would your reaction be? And would you make the same link that you made? Are we pontificating today? I think we might be.
I don't know. I think we're trying to understand. And I think we're trying to make sense of something. Do we have to? No. Do the stories stand on their own? Yes, they do. But
how do you read these without, as you said, I mean, you nailed it with this idea of interchangeability, that once you start talking about human beings in that way, you are on the road to this. And is Shalamov an extreme example? I don't think so. It isn't. Because most people who go through this don't survive to tell it.
Yeah.
But again, it gets us off how great these stories are. And can I just read one other part of this one?
Yeah.
So they're digging this guy up. Here we are, said Bagristov. He had touched a human digit. I mean, just like, I hate to, again, a shout out. I criticized a translator earlier, but this is in translation. A big toe was poking out of the stones, and it was perfectly visible in the moonlight. The toe was not like Glebov's or Baristov's, not just because it was lifeless and stiff. Theirs were too, which is right there. Damn. The dead man's toenails had been cut, and the toe was fatter and softer than Gleebus because he hasn't been, presumably, out there that long. They quickly flung aside the stones dumped over the body. "Quite young," said Barastov. That's it. That's the only time they have any notion of kind of who this person might be. Although they do say later he's a pretty big lad, but that's it, you know. Anyway, I think we fall into the trap of just kind of showing that these are documents of a time, and I hope we've done a little justice to the fact that, you know, what weird accident of history that have this guy survive that he could write these stories and not be reporting them, because this is not reportage.
So I just want to point to one thing, and I would like to hear what you have to say about it, where it says, "The blue light of the moon, which had now risen, shone on the stones, on the thin polar forest, picking out every ledge, every tree in a special light that was not like daylight. Everything seemed real in its own way, but not its daytime self. This was a sort of second nocturnal aspect of the world. The corpse's linen grew warm from being close to Glebov's body. It no longer seemed to belong to someone else." "I could do with a smoke," said Glebov dreamily. "You can have a smoke tomorrow," said Bagristov, smiling. "Tomorrow they would sell the clothes and get some bread, perhaps even a bit of tobacco in exchange."
One last thought about interchangeability. These stories are not interchangeable. You know, they are often about getting bread, that's true. But I keep trying to figure out how to say how good these stories are. And I think the days might have felt interchangeable, and they certainly felt interchangeable to Shalamov. And I think maybe the true genius of this work is that he was able to make these experiences so particular that even not just he does honor to the people, but he does honors to the fact that they were living in the time they spent. And that's why. And they're not monotonous. You know, I can't say I would read five in a night. One might be enough. One is enough. One's enough for a week. But next week I would open it again. Remember I mentioned the other day that I tried to read one of these a day, and that's too much. That's too much. One every couple of days. Because they're so good, you need to give them each.
There is another bit of the defamiliarization, because as you say, the days were not interchangeable, not necessarily. Like you would think, like they're, you know, carving the tick marks on the wall of how many days. But so the argument about the artistry and the creativity,
which no one is really arguing against what
no,
we're saying.
I know. But I just want to underscore it then.
Right.
But it is this defamiliarization, not just of the berries in the other story, but of the blue light of the moon, which, I mean, who can describe the blue light of the moon in quite this way? Shone on the stones, on the very stones that were covering up that body that they were so eager to move so they could get the things that they were going to trade or sell or wear. On the thin polar forest, picking out every ledge, every tree in a special light that was not like daylight. I mean, that's poetry.
Oh, 100%. But I think he wasn't, like any good writer, he's not dwelling on the poetry. Any good prose writer, let's say, or any good poet. No poet dwells on the poetry either. No good poet, no great poet. So Shalamov is just, you know, but you said about the days of the interchangeable. I think they probably were in real life, but when he got back to a desk decades later, mm-hmm. He was able to create living fiction out of them. This is not a memoir. It's not a piece of nonfiction. These are stories. And I think that's extremely deliberate. And I think that choice is what makes them so distinct. And he's often compared to Solzhenitsyn, and I think it's a little unfair. You know, they're just two very different writers, and you know, and it's worth saying just because it's kind of interesting, and maybe we don't need this. But Shalamov was a communist with a capital C. He was he didn't think Stalin was a communist. You know, he lived and died by communism. He believed in it. Solzhenitsyn, of course, didn't. And so they're different. And in some ways, the fact that a true believer is writing these stories, someone who never gave up on that dream, this is my understanding of his life, I might, you know, be taking it too far, is also pretty extraordinary. That your politics, no matter how, he somehow didn't allow his arguably zealot politics to interfere with how great an artist he was. But maybe you have to be a little crazy, you know, to be this good.
I do like this line, I could do with a smoke. You can have a smoke tomorrow. What hope?
Yeah.
What hope?
Yeah.
About tomorrow, about the another day.
Yeah, and tomorrow they would be able to sell the clothes and get some bread, perhaps even a bit of tobacco in exchange.
Varlam Shalimov is the author of Berries, At Night, and RUR. They can be found in the collection Kolyma Stories, translated by Donald Rayfield. This has been The Lonely Voice with Peter Orner. Jacob Rosati composed our theme music. Dan Katz is Texas Public Radio's news director. I'm Yvette Benavides.